Blog Talk Radio.
Radio program. I'm Susan Larison-Danz, and I am just so delighted to be back now from Los Angeles, having taken just a little bit of a break since our live show out there. And I do appreciate all of you that came out to visit the booth or came to the talk in LA. That was a wonderful experience. And I do want to encourage those of you who missed me at the booth, because I know some of you were looking for me, please do not hesitate to email me at info@frontierbeyondfear.com, because I'm always happy to interact with you after the talk or whatever you'd like to talk about. So just want to encourage you on that. So now we are launching another new series of shows, some wonderful guests coming up, including tonight's guest. I am so looking forward to talking to, and I will have him on the line here in just a second. His name is Philip Camella, and Philip has written what is really a fascinating book that I feel is so long overdue and so very much needed in this world, The Collapse of Materialism, Visions of Science, Dreams of God. And tonight we are going to be talking about the materialist worldview, which I will allow Philip to define here in a moment, and how that has led us down a path away from a much more expansive, productive worldview for humanity. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Just let me tell you a little bit about Philip. Philip is actually a lawyer, and that is very much reflected in his approach to his work and to this book, which took many, many years for him to develop. And you can really see the intricacy of the logic in the book. It is a very logical book that approaches this subject in an important way, in a way that I feel can help those who may not be on board with this idea of a shift in consciousness and a new worldview may begin to understand in a logical way. Philip's website is thecollapseofmaterialism.com. And I do invite you to visit that after the show. And without any further delay, I'm using a new computer here tonight, by the way. It's been one of those nights. I had one computer fail, and we're bringing up another one here. So with just a slight delay, I'm bringing Philip here on the line, which is, here we go. Hello, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for having me, Susan. It's really good to be here. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Yes, yes, me too. I am just so delighted to have you here. I guess the best way to start out with this is for you to tell us, Philip, how did this work come to be? How did you, as a lawyer, in the midst of all your experiences of life, come to be called to do this work?
Well, first of all, I always say that I'm a man first, probably a philosopher second, and a lawyer third.
Uh-huh.
The book itself grew out of a college paper that, like a lot of people, I never finished. I had an idea for the book in college. I was a philosophy major, and I thought that I came upon a way to reconcile science and religion. And so I sort of had the concept, but without the skill set and without the knowledge background to really write the book. And so it's something that I have been driven to do. You know, people talk about their missions, their callings, their passion. It's something ingrained in me. And so I start off with the concept in college, and I, as I said, I didn't quite have the skill set, and I developed it, but then I had to go to law school, and I just continued working it through, working on drafts in the back of napkins and notebook paper and one draft after another, and so 35 years later, here's the book. That's sort of the thumbnail sketch.
Well, those are the most wonderful projects of all, really, that are essentially a life's work. And, you know, what I appreciate about your book, you know, we hear about the theory of everything and this concept of, you know, how do we approach understanding our world? And yet your book really makes us think about how we're not even considering, so many of us, what our assumptions have been. And right. and how we're even thinking about discovering truth. And it makes us question everything and come back to the beginning.
Right, right. And I think that's what I really try to do, because there's a lot of books that try to reconcile science and religion by sort of looking at them already formed in their current format, like read the big read the book of Genesis and try to see how the Big Bang could be consistent with it. But what I try to do, and what I hope I came close to accomplishing, is to start from square one. Start with nothing.
Yes.
Start with no assumptions. Start with no assumptions. And we forget that's really the beginning of philosophy. And, you know, philosophy is a very unpopular subject now, mostly because it's hard to get a paycheck and do it at the same time. But Descartes, who's considered to be the founding father of modern philosophy, he started with this same system. He said, "What is beyond doubt?" And his answer was the thought process itself. I think, therefore I am. He's the guy that started this whole thing. And so what science has done, though, is that science has gone beyond that and said, well, let's assume that there is an independent world, a world independent of our minds that really exists out there, because we need this assumption in order to practice science. And so you have this conflict here between Descartes, and I'm just using him as sort of a metaphor, but Descartes, who's saying that the only thing we cannot doubt is the thinking process itself. Anything else is subject to doubt. In fact, Descartes, in his Meditations, he says, it's one of the great books ever written, it's about 80 pages long, he says, "The world itself might be a dream, but then again, God would not deceive me in the thinking this world was real unless it really was real." And with that step, he took the scientific approach and said, well, the world really does exist. And so what I'm saying is, let's start from the beginning. Let's assume the world does exist, but let's assume that it's not independent of us. And so this is where I sort of take Descartes' beginning point, and I go off in a different direction. And Susan, that's really what the beginning is. And I think that, you know, I'm a logical person. I'm not the touchy-feely type. I'm not. Uh-huh. I haven't had an epiphany of sorts. Uh-huh. I think things through, my contribution here is that you could be spiritual and logical at the same time. You could be scientific and you could be spiritual, because both of these things have to be true, but we just have to adjust our perspectives.
Yes. Yes. And you know, I appreciate that, because I think that many of us who have even had spiritual experiences, I count myself in this group, where I've wanted to prove certain things. I know one of the things in your book that you talk about just in one section is synchronicity, for example. And I think of that in terms of statistics, you know, that it's just impossible. You know, it's not something you can just ignore, and it's statistically impossible for some of these things to occur. And I think that we want to be able to prove things, Philip, because we want to shift their way of thinking about the world. And that's what I appreciate about your book, is that, you know, you started out really in saying we're being led down a path by a lot of false assumptions, and that it's not really leading humanity to a good place. And so,
right.
So it matters to be logical. It matters that we can bring more people on board to thinking in a more expansive way.
Right. In some ways, what I'm doing here is I'm applying the methods of science, which is basically logical steps, reasoning, and evidence, experimentation. Apply the questioning of science against science's own assumptions. Have science turn back against itself and question its own assumptions. And when you do that, the assumptions, particularly this independent material world, collapses. That's what it's about. And there's so much evidence of it. I still think we're a little ahead of the time, although I think the time's fast approaching with all the different developments, whether it's in alternate forms of healing, whether it's parapsychology with Dean Radin, whether it's near-death experiences with Evan Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different examples of where we're starting to see a convergence towards a consciousness-first approach. And my thing is, let's do this, and let's be rational, scientific creatures about it.
Yes.
If we don't have go on a yoga retreat. Not that there's anything wrong with yoga, but we don't have to go on some kind of retreat to the Himalayas in order to understand this. We could think it through. We could be logical, and yet we could find a home for both our spiritual instincts, our movement towards oneness, and our need for a rational understanding of who we are and what we're doing here. And so I'm I think this is where I might be a little different in that I'm trying to have this logical foundation for this. So.
Well, and you do a good job of establishing it. And I feel like, you know, what is the motivation that we would have for exploring this logically is, and why do we have science? Do we want to know the truth about our world or not? And
right.
I really sense that a lot of people are in denial about what's actually happening in the world. And I often wonder, I mean, you spend time talking about quantum physics, which comes up all the time. A lot of people are discussing that now. It has to be that a lot of what that is describing about our world has to be troubling to people who expect it to work in a materialistic way. And maybe we should define right at the outset this word materialism. Maybe we better define that even more specifically as to exactly what the materialist view encompasses and how it also puts us into categories, which I find interesting, how it subdivides us.
Right. Well, in the most simple terms, under materialism, the ultimate reality is a thing. It's stuff. It's dead matter.
Yeah.
Not God. It's not spirit. It's dead matter. And from that standpoint, certain things follow, which is that mind and emotion don't communicate with each other. There's no connection between our consciousness, our mind, and the outer world, because all there is matter in motion. The world has no purpose because if all that exists is matter, there is no purpose. If you read the leading books on evolution, and this is the Richard Dawkins style,
mm-hmm.
evolution mm-hmm. has no goal, there's no purpose. It's just random mutations happen to generate this world of endless order. Materialism also, I think importantly, it separates us from God, because God is out there somewhere in a different world, if he even exists. It separates
yeah.
us from the physical world. We tend not to appreciate nature because we think it's an alien creation. It's a random creation from the Big Bang, and it separates us from other people. We don't view each other as brothers and sisters. We view ourselves as sort of separated robots going down our own little path. So the most important thing, I think, with materialism to understand is that it's a world without meaning, without purpose. All it is matter in motion. I think a good example of this, which is really a metaphor, is the Large Hadron Collider, where they're looking for the God particle.
Yes, yes.
For God in a particle. The ultimate quest of science becomes to find that ultimate particle. I personally think that is ridiculous, but that is the leading message of modern physics. And I think there's something wrong with it. And people ask me what inspires me. Well, sometimes I have negative inspiration. I feel like
uh-huh.
something is so wrong that it inspires me to come up with an argument against it. So that's really what materialism is about. It's a world of separation. It's a world without meaning, without purpose, where we look outward for truth instead of inward.
Yeah. You know, there's something very, very ironic in the sense that God would be considered so small in a way to be equated with a particle, and how perfect that is to describe the materialist worldview is, it limits us. And
right, right.
Now, those who look at this view of the world as a dream, that can feel uncomfortable too, as to, you know, what is reality? And how is my perception related to your perception? And I know philosophers have thought about that. By the way, I appreciate that you mentioned philosophy. I've often thought that nowadays the people who would have been philosophers are probably in the self-help field or something, but we've lost something. Well, it used to be you learned how to live by listening to philosophers.
Right.
And it's funny, recently, I'm not a philosopher. I may be a philosopher, but I hadn't really studied it as much as I could have during my education. And lately, I've been studying some of the philosophers, and I'm learning a great deal. And a lot of people, that knowledge has been lost. It's not even considered that important in our educational systems anymore. And we're missing out on understanding life itself when we don't explore that.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like, I mean, first of all, you know, philosophy and science were at one time the same thing. I mean, Aristotle
uh-huh.
was a philosopher and a scientist. It was called natural philosophy with science. It's the philosophy
uh-huh.
of nature. And eventually it evolved basically at the time of Newton, where he started predicting the movement of the planets and the solar system and particles, and it became fashionable to imagine that there is this great network, this great mechanical network of stars and planets out there, the Newton's machine world, the mechanical universe, to like study as if it's a specimen. We lost touch with creation at that point. The other thing about philosophy is that really what, to me, it's about just the questioning process. Don't take anything on faith, and don't be afraid of the big questions. It's sort of like if you want to learn to play the piano, you've got to learn the rules of playing the piano. You can't
mm-hmm.
fake it. If you want to learn how to fly a jet airplane, you've got to take that instruction manual out and read it. You can't just go up on a frolic and detour, a joyride. Too many of us live our lives without without even considering what we're doing here. And there's so many distractions, and there's so many responsibilities, there's so many pressures. I understand it. But what I'm saying is that in this day and age, we owe it to ourselves to take a 1 or 2 day sabbatical, a month sabbatical, and just think about it a couple times a day, once a month or whatever. Read a couple of these mind opening books and think about the big questions. And so that's what my book is trying to be, a sort of a one stop shopping for this. Okay. I have put a lot of thinking in here. I'm thinking, okay, you don't have to read 10 different books. You don't have to read The Origin of the Species and A Brief History of Time and The Elegant Universe and all these other books. Here's a counter argument. It lays it all out. You may not go with it. You may think differently. But if you want to have a different view of the world that makes sense, read this book. And that's sort of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say there's a different way of looking at things. Time out. Try it this way. Think for yourself and see what conclusions you reach.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Yes, and you really do provide quite a survey of what many different thinkers have said, and it's true that many of us have lost touch with that, and it's helpful. I mean, nowadays in our busy world, a lot of people don't have time to go back and re-educate ourselves, and so a book like yours is a service for us, in a sense that we don't have to reinvent the wheel that you've been working on for all these years and have placed it down in understandable terms and in a way that we can approach. I want to talk a little bit more about the real dream and the one mind, and what does that have to say about the true nature of reality? And how do we know that we are one mind? How can we know that?
Okay, well, this is a logical, there's a logical answer to that. And here it goes. First of all, leaving aside parapsychology, which I'll get to in a second, but suppose you have, let's say, 1 million people staring up at the sky, okay? And under the current scientific perspective, the reason why all those people see the same sky is because there is one heaven, one cosmos, branching all across the celestial sphere. There's one independent world out there, and there's 1 million separate people on Earth staring at it, okay? I'm saying reverse the perspective. The reason we see the same sky is because we're participating in the same dream and we have the same mind. See, this one mind is the same thing that we know as God, as the collective unconsciousness of Carl Jung, of all the great thinkers who have said that there's a oneness to reality. Mm-hmm. We are united at the core. Now, I also think that the parapsychology, mind over matter, mind reading, telepathy, love, all the emotions that bring people together is another bit of evidence for oneness. We also feel it within ourselves. Where did the idea of God come from? Where did this idea of divinity come from? My answer is, well, it comes from us because we're part of it. It's natural to us. And so when you look at, and then there's one more thing that I'll add here that I think is, to me, very powerful if you want to, you know, list your evidence. But when we hallucinate, when somebody hallucinates, it always amazed me, because how can the mind of one person project a world that fools that person into believing it's real, or that is every bit as real as the public world? How can one person hallucinate that mirage out in the distance? Well, just imagine, and this is an inferential step. Well, if one mind could hallucinate something that's mistaken for the world at large, then wouldn't a united mind be able to project the public world? And ironically, there's a quote from Sir James Jeans I just happen to have here.
Mm-hmm.
This is, and he was a physicist from the 20th century. He wrote a book called The Mysterious Universe. He has a quote. It says, "Creations of an individual mind may reasonably be called less substantial than creations of a universal mind." See, this is a physicist 100 years ago saying the same thing I'm saying. So, and Susan, you don't have to go. I mean, to me, this step is the beginning of this is how we explain things, and it's real because we are part of it. It's as real to us as a mechanical world would be to a robot. The world, the reason why it seems so real to us is because we're part of it, just like in any other dream. And it's something that maybe takes some thinking, but at the end of the day, nothing changes. It's only our perception that changes. It's our perspective that changes. We start viewing the world as part of us. We look at our brothers and sisters. We're part of a brotherhood, sisterhood of humankind, just what all the great spiritual teachers have taught. So this is just some of it. Man, you know, it's deep and everything, but to me, this gives me satisfaction because I'm able to say now we're starting to make progress here, because we could see a unity between spirituality and science. See? So that's really sort of a thumbnail sketch of you know, the real dream worldview.
Yes. Well, there's nothing wrong with diving deeper. I mean, that's why we're here. We don't have to. Far too many things. What's interesting about your approach is that it is very deep, but it's also very understandable. The more you enter into thinking about the world in this way. I have a question. When you think about the dreams that we have collectively, something I've observed with subgroups, for example, like I came from an evangelical background. Right now, I'm no longer a part of that group, but I observe how evangelicals, for example, right now make sense of a lot of the things going on in the world by looking at prophecy, and they see all kinds of confirmations of that too, which is really interesting. Like they're really projecting this reality together, and they're dreaming it together, it seems, and they see even sort of synchronicities that seem to verify it in their own way, and I wonder about this. Is that, can groups, I mean, we're all one ultimate mind, but can groups have a collective dream together?
Well, I think that that's one of the challenges of what I would call a new science. You call it science, if you will. And one of the questions would be, what does a critical mass look like to change the world?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that the my analogy that I'm going with for the time being is sort of a giant cruise ship. How many people have to get to one side for the cruise ship to tilt? I mean, when you look at the planet Earth, there are 7 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes united effort to change the world. What my thing is that if humankind accepted this with the same level of buy-in as the law of gravity, now we're talking about something here. Because the whole idea is to build a better world from the inside out. You know, modern science, with the materialistic viewpoint, wants to build a better world from the outside in. They want to unite us with the machine. They want us probably all to fly hovercrafts and be those self-propelled rockets. They want us to put, you know, they want to do transplants
They want to transplant us, like you say, into a robot, you know, so that we live forever.
Exactly. right. Example is plastic surgery, which is sort of a mechanical way to look younger. Well, let's try looking younger from the inside out and see if that works better. I mean, to me, that's a whole lot more promising. I'm doing this for the intellectual pleasure, yes, but I'm not doing it just for my health. I think that I am doing this for my health, I should say.
Well,
I think
for all of our health.
Health. Right. This is the way we really change the world. And it's sort of like taking control of the cruise ship and steering in a direction where we could all benefit. And yeah, this is early. This is it's pretty far out there in a way. But if you set your goal along the right course, and you have that high ideal and you make progress towards it, eventually we're going to get there. What I'm saying is that material science is never going to get us to the promised land. They're never going to get us to the place where we could all merge with robots, where we could all, you know, live till 150 with all sorts of different transplants. I think that's it's going to be a big failure, but there's hope if we focus on the inner spirit and start acting like a family instead of a bunch of people, you know, fighting over lines and their place in line before God or different parcels of land or religious sites, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So there's the long-term objective here, which is to point us in a direction that is more promising than where we're heading.
Yes. You know, one of the things I've observed, I don't do this so much anymore, but there in the past at times I would engage atheists on Twitter in debates, as if you could really get in a debate on Twitter. But they tend to have real assumptions when you say the word God. They just assume that you're talking about a particular God associated, usually, if it's in the United States, with Christianity. Honestly, that tends to be what they believe. It's you know, that if you talk about God, well, that's what it means. And what I appreciate about thinking more expansively is, you know, we don't need to define God that way. I could agree with them that I'm an atheist with respect to that definition of God, too. You know, I mean, I don't necessarily believe in that God either, but that doesn't mean that I don't believe in God in a broader sense. And so it seems like there are just so many assumptions. And even our terminology, we're not even talking about the same things, and there's a lot of hostility too. There's a chapter in your book, what I've encountered the most, honestly, from people who have questions about God, is the existence of evil in the world, is that it's so upsetting that certain things happen in this world that it's almost horrifying to consider that there could be a God. And so that's a really frightening thing to consider, that there could be any kind of God. And that's a pretty deep question that you address, and I wonder if you could explore that, because I know on Blog Talk Radio we have listeners of all kinds of views, I'd like if you could explore that a little.
Oh, sure. First of all, let me just say that I had a atheist on my radio show, Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, about a year or so ago, and I know him. He's a great guy, and he presents himself as an atheist. I asked him the question. I said, when you say you're an atheist, are you saying that you don't believe in, say, Jesus Christ, or that Jesus Christ rose from the dead, or are you saying that you also don't think that there's an underlying unity, divinity to humankind? And he thought about it. He goes, well, I'm not willing to go that far. So the point, you know, you're exactly right, Susan, that it's all in the terminology. I think that, unfortunately, a lot of science, particularly on the evolutionary side of things, the Darwin side of things, is a reaction against traditional Orthodox religion. They sort of like use traditional religion as a rag doll and just like pound it around. Well, religion has progressed to spirituality, to this one mind, to consciousness, to the New Age thinking, and it's it's gone way beyond where it was, where a lot of modern thinkers are going down the same path. I mean, one of the influential books for me is Paul Davies, called The Mind of God.
Uh-huh.
And Paul Davies, you know, is a Arizona State professor, one of the great science writers of our era. A lot of great books. He's writing a book called The Mind of God. Now let me move to the problem of evil, which I do think is the number one argument against the existence of God.
Yes, it is.
And the vision there is that there's an all good God overhead, sort of like in the Sistine Chapel, and he or she is looking down at us. And why does this person allow evil to exist?
Yes,
Nazi
that's
Germany.
That's always the question.
Being,
yes.
Being for 9/11, and we could list, you know, atrocities.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, under my view, the answer is that evil exists because we are God and we are ultimately free. We are creating this world as we are going. There is nobody above us that's planning anything. The only thing that's above us is our vision of what we're supposed to be, of how we're supposed to be. It's called our conscience. It's very simple. It's very simple. It's just like the atheist would say it is, which is there isn't anybody out there. There's no puppet master, so to speak. All there is us. And so to me, that answers the question. We are a God in training. We're trying to understand.
I love that.
We are.
I've thought of that many times. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, you know, there are a lot of people who share that worldview. And I've been really surprised at some of the people who share that. I don't know how, and I'm not saying that I need to be careful here probably on my show, especially during prime time, but there was a show once where I called in. I used to call into a network show quite a bit, and they had someone who had left the Satanic Church, for example, and he was describing a worldview now in a different way. There were some dark things. I'm not talking about dark things, but just that they, too, were exploring this concept. And, of course, you know, Christians and a lot of people will react against that, saying, well, that has to be evil. But what, and I'm not saying there weren't some dark things associated with those philosophies, but I found it really interesting how a lot of different groups are converging in this place of essentially being God in training, in a sense, like an aspect of God, a created aspect where we feel separate, but we're really not. And like we're re-deriving God,
right,
in a sense. And I love to think about it that way. I was actually really shocked that night that I agreed with this guy, and other people were kind of surprised. But it was funny because we were just, I mean, at least in that place, there was some agreement. And in a way, I thought, well, that's an example of the unity. I mean, that we like to categorize everybody, and that's a real extreme categorization, and yet a lot of the same ideas are arising in different places, and I find that fascinating. And so,
yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, the reason why this is not such an odd perspective is that Hinduism and Buddhism, they're based upon the same. I mean, Hinduism says that Atman, the self, is part of Brahman, God, that the self is part of God. It's the same thing. The twist that I will put on it, and I think this is really, really important.
Yes.
That it's easy sitting here talking about oneness, divinity, we're all part of the one mind, all part of God, conceptually. But if you don't have a job, or you've been a victim of abuse, and you don't have enough to eat, and people are kicking you, it's hard to have divine feelings when you're trying to live.
You're surviving. Yeah. I mean, you're trying to survive.
Right. Exactly. So this is a this is not only to say we're in training, we are sort of how can I put this? We are personifying this oneness on the planet Earth. And I'm trying not to use all these touchy-feely terms here, but when you consider the fact how difficult it is to make peace, it's because people have so many differences that are inborn. You know, the Jews and the Muslims, the Catholics and the Protestants. I mean, the blacks and the white. I mean, you could go on and on and on. The Russians and the Ukraine. I mean, it goes on and on because we view these superficial differences as some kind of absolute barriers, and it's generational, and we bring all this baggage, and you know, luckily there's hope because so many people are saying the same thing, which is, hey, break free of that conditioning, be your own person, write your own story, don't let people tell you how to live, be open-minded, all this stuff that you've had a lot of people on your show and my show, so many books out there saying sort of the same thing, which is that be your own person, be authentic.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately a good thing because it's leading us to be true to ourselves and to not be conditioned and not be controlled by culture, society, upbringing, etc. So.
Well, you know, it may sound somewhat touchy-feely, but a minute ago, you know, you talk about conscience. And often on this show, we talk about this concept of God being love, you know, which is something many of us were taught. And yet, what does that really mean? I mean, what would that mean? Does that mean God is controlling and makes us be loving? No. Does that mean that we're learning? I love this concept. You know, I have thought about this too so many times, that we are learning to be more compassionate. That's what I'm seeing more people say, and a lot of us are drawing that conclusion ourselves, that a lot of these free choice exercises on this planet to help us to learn are exercises in compassion, which are actually conscience exercises, because when you're exercising your conscience, you act from compassion. You don't act from selfishness or competitiveness or, you know, just trampling all over people. You're compassionate. And so I really do feel it's leading us to a higher truth. And you know, maybe now we can talk, Philip, about, you know, once we get to that point, and this is definitely something that's come up on multiple shows here, is that then leads us to the ability to really co-create a much more wonderful reality for the planet, you know.
Right.
And so we raise ourselves above where there won't be so many people, there won't be anyone in survival mode anymore, perhaps, you know, once we get to this point, and then we can really create. And so I was wondering if you could talk about that. These shows go by so fast, and, you know, just what is our goal? You know, we're guiding this spaceship. Where do we want it to go? Where can we go?
Well, the answer to that is sort of right in front of us. It's in all the great spiritual books. The goal in my mind is heaven on earth. That's always been the goal.
Yes. Yeah.
And it goes by different names, and it's always been sort of, to me, that's the dream of God. You know, my book is Visions of Science, Dreams of God. The dream of God, and of course I am speculating, but the dream has to be to fulfill the mission of creating a heaven on earth, which is another way of saying make these people get along with each other so that they could build a common home. The world itself, and Susan, this is something that science is terrible at that we forget about. We are living in an incredible miracle that we take for granted, because it's a big bang and there's a multiverse and we're just one of 18 billion billion other universes, and so who cares? And because there'll be a big crunch someday and there'll be another creation, so heck with it. I mean, they sort of trivialize this amazing miracle that if you ponder it, I mean, it's sort of like, why is there something to begin with? I mean, a lot of people have asked that question, and there's no answer. See, to me, there is no answer. Yes, I believe that the world is a dream of God, as nutty as that may sound to some people, but to me, we'll never know how dreams are possible. That is a gift we have been given, and I don't know how, and no one's ever going to answer that question. But we at least need to take care of this miracle that has been gifted to us. And so when you combine this little system I have here, which of course is also built upon intellectual history, which is unite in physical form, that which is united in spiritual form, and by that I mean peace on earth, unite to a common goal, there's something in it for everybody, and we start combining our efforts, our visions to this common goal, and I do think eventually the payback is a heaven on earth. We are a young people.
Yeah.
I don't know how you add up the ages, but you could tell by looking at the front page of the newspaper, we have a lot of learning to do. And we think, and this is my opinion, and I could be wrong, but we think because we master technology that we've mastered the self. We have not mastered the self. We can't even pick up the garbage on the street half the time, or feed people, or shelter people, and think that we're so advanced. So point being, we're young, we have a long way to go, but to me, the goal is clear, it's far in the distance, it's a heaven on earth, and I somebody's got to be crazy enough to actually think it could happen, and I'm the person, so here I am.
That seems to come up more and more. There are lots of people, even that subgroup, each in their own way. I mean, the evangelicals who are all focused on the end times right now, their ultimate goal is heaven on earth. And that's true of many groups that I've found. It seems like we have an innate desire for this. We may think of it in different ways. I mean, I tend to think, and I imagine you would definitely agree, that heaven on earth is a very creative place. It's not, sometimes people like to think of heaven as sort of a, you just do nothing kind of place. You know, you've reached this state of wonderful peace and that's it. It's just still. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't believe that. I think we're in a very creative multiverse, use that word, and that heaven on earth would be a stepping stone. I mean, how do you feel about how big this multiverse most likely is? I mean, just the universe we know is huge.
Yeah.
And that establishing a higher consciousness planet is also a step to being a part of what about the other higher consciousness planets? You have to believe, and this is logic. I use logic a lot in this area because you have to. Is that it's only logical that there would be other advanced civilizations, and that technology may not be very advanced. You know, that may actually be not the type of society that does all that well. And that it's really once you get beyond that, or maybe use it in some way, but maybe you won't need it even eventually, that, we've got to logically conclude that we're not alone and we could interact, someday.
Yeah, I've been softening my stance on the whole extraterrestrial. I had a guy in my show a week or two ago, Richard Lawrence, who's an extraterrestrial researcher. And he was a very logical, thoughtful guy. Basically is a medium for extraterrestrials, which sounds pretty strange, but there's a lot of media, a lot of real mediums out there, I think, who do have contacts with, quote unquote, the source and oneness and everything. And so I think it's possible. My own view is that we need to focus on number one, which is planet Earth. We have so much work to do here. And so it's great that more and more people are becoming unafraid or unintimidated to go in this direction. You know, there's that Seal song called Crazy, which I quote, you know, which I quote in my book. And, you know, he has a line says, why do so few people want to fly? Isn't that crazy? You know, talks about why aren't there more big dreamers? Aren't we being crazy for not dreaming big? And that's the way I look at that. And I think that, hey, it is crazy not to dream bigger, because we are still, even talking right now, we're still immersed in this materialistic mindset where we think there's some strangeness to this. And I'm saying break out of that as fast as you can, because the possibilities are unlimited. Imagine yourself a screenwriter. Are you gonna write a story where you die after, you know, 45 minutes when you're 35 years old in a car accident, or you're gonna dream that you're gonna be, you know, a divine god on earth or an angel or something? I mean, write a better story for yourself. Put yourself in a better position. And that's what I'm saying. Build big dreams, write a story with a happy ending. It's in our control. The problem is that we can't do this alone. You can't do it alone. And this is what the great spiritual teachings say. There has to be brotherhood, morality. You can't steer that by yourself. And so there is a certain amount of evangelistic tendency here, although I'm not really that type, although people have accused me of it, but I'm more of the slow persuasion type, frankly.
Well, when you care about the future of the planet, I think that it's perfectly justified to be persuasive. I think it is.
Essentially persuade themselves.
Yes. Yeah, I have tended to find that, the more expansive we think, we suddenly realize that it was just logical. One of the things, and I don't want to dwell too much on this, but the reason I brought up, that we're in this giant multiverse is that otherwise it tends to become almost too Earth-centric. You know, we're like the center of everything. Not to say that we shouldn't focus on this planet. It's where we are. But I think it helps for us to realize that, we're part of a very grand reality. And it doesn't make us smaller either. It actually makes us grander, which seems contradictory. But, just to be a part of that. In a holographic way.
Yeah, no, I think I just did a blog on my website, The Collapse of Materialism. I just did a blog on, based upon my show with Richard Lawrence, the extraterrestrial researcher, and it was about this topic, about how if we are, as we extend ourselves into outer space, are we really exploring the depth of inner space. That's really what it's about. And I'm, as I said before, I used to be more of a doubter on near-death experiences, and I'm coming around to that. And after talking to Richard Lawrence, I'm starting to be more, I'm softening my stance. I'm the one that believes in open-mindedness, so I'm not going to shut off something. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to shut off something just because it sounds a little strange, but I'm open-minded to it. I think you make a good point. It's an unbelievable universe out there. And as time goes on, who knows what adventures might be in store for us. I am very optimistic about how this is going, and it's primarily because I just see it being a sort of a building mass, an accelerating mass of people who are searching for something more and something that has some substance to it, so we could start explaining things better, start explaining synchronicities, start explaining energy healing, try to extend our lifespans, try to stay younger longer, all these things that so much of us want. And I'm just hoping that I'm not going to be the only one that's going down this path. And I think
more and more are jumping on board, honestly. I think that and you're helping, because you're helping to bring people on who might be reluctant to look at this, and you bring it to people in a way that they need to hear it, quite honestly, a logical way. And you know, with that said, we're heading into the last few minutes of the program, and I want to, you know, first of all, thank you so much for being on the show, and then also invite you to tell the audience just a little bit more about, you know, where they can find you, and even about your own show, and just whatever you'd like to convey here right at the end.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Susan. And as I said, I do have a radio show as well. It's called Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, and it's on webtalkradio.net. And my book is called The Collapse of Materialism, and the same as the website. It's called the same thing. And my email address, if someone has any questions, it's philipcamella@gmail.com. That's C-O-M-E-L-L-A. The object, as we've been discussing here, is to be scientific and spiritual at the same time, and to try to make sense of a new way of thinking. And I just hope that others see some value in this and contribute, open their minds, make their own decisions, but stay open-minded. There's a big, wide world out there that I think we have a chance to take advantage of if we set our sights higher. So thank you very much, Susan.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for that reminder, because being open-minded and also open-hearted, I might add, just that, you know, it's going to create a better world. And I do appreciate your being here tonight. So thank you again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick show note before the show goes down, the live feed goes down. I do have another show tomorrow. We have a daytime show tomorrow, Wednesday, February 18th, for those of you listening in the podcast later. A couple of really good shows here, right back to back. Tomorrow, I have Dr. Jamie Turndorf on the show, and she's going to talk about her new book, Love Never Dies: How to Reconnect and Make Peace with the Deceased. And that's at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. And I'm really looking forward to talking to her, because she's really sharing her heart through that book about her own experience with her husband who passed away, and how that led her to a new way of thinking about grief. So join us tomorrow for that. Again, I want to remind you that our guest today, Philip Camilla, his book is The Collapse of Materialism, Visions of Science, Dreams of God. And you can find his website, thecollapseofmaterialism.com. His show will be highlighted on frontierbeyondfear.com for quite some time, where you can access the entire archive of shows. We're going on 5 years. This is, entering into the fifth year now of this show on Blog Talk Radio. And I'm just so delighted to welcome researchers like Philip, who are really making a difference in the world. So thank you, everyone, for being here. And I hope you, too, think about your world more expansively. We can all release our assumptions and find our way to a much more open world. And yes, open the door to heaven on earth. Take care, everyone. Thank you.